You're listening to a 3CR podcast of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia.
Radio MMT respectfully acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land from which we are broadcasting, the Wurundjeri people, and we are broadcasting to the Kulin nations. Our focus is economics, that is, how stuff is produced and distributed. We recognise that for many tens of thousands of years, First Nations people's connection to country successfully embodied the world's oldest continuous economy, which was catastrophically disrupted by genocide and displacement. We acknowledge that we have much to learn to reshape our current extractive and exploitive system to achieve sustainable prosperity for everyone.
Radio MMT. Economics for the rest of us with Anne
and Kev.
Radio MMT.
Looking at the world through the lens of modern monetary theory.
Radio MMT.
Macroeconomics for a well-being economy.
Macroeconomics? Like, isn't that incredibly boring?
No, Kevin, it's incredibly interesting. It's all about who gets what and why.
Who gets what and why? Okay, I'm in.
Radio MMT at gmail.com.
Incredibly interesting macroeconomics for the rest of us.
And you are with Radio MMT here on 3CR Community Radio, and I am Anne, your host. And dear listener, Kev is coming in from distant places. How are you doing, Kev?
Anne, I'm well. I'm still here in Taree. I haven't moved. I'm staying in the one place, Taree, which is north of Newcastle. It's called the Mid-Coast. It's in the Goldilocks zone where it's not too hot, not too cold. That's what they reckon.
I just can see you in your Goldilocks van.
Yeah. I'm sitting with the door open, shorts and a T-shirt, looking at gum trees, and it's all very pleasant.
Well, I won't get too jealous because you are going to be missing out on pub night tonight, Kev.
If there's one thing I can say, since I've been in Taree, I haven't been out at night once since I've been here. There's no nightlife. There's no bands. It's a country town, and it's a daytime place, not a nighttime place.
So you've been getting pretty healthy then.
I told you I've been rowing here. I've got this horrendous rowing event on tomorrow where I've been lured in to fill in for a seat on this 16-kilometre row, which I've never done a row like that before, and I'm a bit scared.
You can just jump overboard if it gets too much.
No, you can't. I don't know if anybody follow rowing at all, but there was an Olympic rower, Sally, who lay down during the middle of a race at the Olympics, and she was nicknamed Lay Down Sally for the rest of her life. So no, you can't. I'm not allowed to. You have to die and be carted out of the boat with honour.
Have you got some good calluses going there?
Yeah, I have, but I don't think my fitness is ready for this one. I am getting fit, but by mistake.
We'll have to see if you're still around for another episode next time.
Yeah.
I just wanted to let our dear listener know that if you do happen to be within an hour of Collingwood, start heading towards the Bendigo Hotel, and I'll see you there in a little after an hour where the economics crew are going to show up.
You're going to the Bendigo tonight?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good pub. Oh, well.
We get around, and this is the same crew, Kev, and speaking of crews, who've finally gotten their act together to have an event in Canberra.
In Canberra? Mm-hmm. Ooh, interstate.
So we're starting to coalesce. We're calling ourselves Public Money, Public Good on the 1st of November. So it's a little way away, but stick it in your calendar if you know anyone in Canberra or you think you might be there yourself. Saturday the 1st of November from 1 to 4pm, so even though it's a Saturday, you can still sleep in. And tickets are free, but it will help us very much if you can register so we can figure out the seating and so on. The tickets are available at Humanitix.
I'm starting my southward sojourn to meet you there on the 1st of November in Canberra, because I think it'll be a well worthwhile event for anybody that can make it. And of course, we're going to try and connect with some of the Canberra people of position and influence to alert them to the way the world really works, which is a bit sad when the people who are controlling the money don't really know what they're doing.
Sometimes I think they do, and I think, well, our purpose is to say we know that you know that we know.
Yeah, and I guess the more of us that know what they should know, and everybody knows how things are supposed to be there, after a while, if everybody knows what's supposed to be going on, they can't pull the bluff anymore, can they? That's our job.
Calling
the bluff. Expose all of this stuff.
And we know they could be spending the money.
Yep.
Yeah, well, speaking of events, this episode we're going to go back to a previous event that was held recently in Melbourne, a forum that was called A New Economic Vision, which was held at Victorian Trades Hall on the 15th of August. So today we're going to hear from the final two speakers, and that would be Emma Dawson of the Chifley Institute and economist Bill Mitchell, who, of course, is the founder of the kind of economics that you and I like to talk about.
He's the guru of MMT, the man who knows too much.
And both of them began by giving some historical context to the current situation of continued mass unemployment in Australia. So, of course, mass unemployment puts hundreds of thousands of Australians into poverty. Bill was also describing how Australia managed to achieve full employment without a job guarantee. In this history that he gives, he will talk about the shift that was deliberately made by policymakers to create unemployment to manage the economy. So let's hear from Bill Mitchell and Emma Dawson as introduced by Owen Bennett from Unionists for a Job Guarantee.
Welcome to Victorian Trades Hall, the heart of the labour movement in Victoria for over 150 years. My name is Owen and I'm a co-founder of Unionists for a Job Guarantee. I'll be your MC for today's event, A New Economic Vision for the Labour Movement. We gather here at a pivotal moment. This month marks 5 decades since the end of post-war full employment. Today we reflect on what that loss has meant, and how we can once again put full employment at the centre of our social contract. Unionists for a Job Guarantee was formed by rank-and-file trade unionists committed to the idea that everyone who wants to work should have the right to a good union job with fair pay, security and dignity. A publicly funded, locally administered job guarantee would not only end involuntary unemployment, it would empower workers, lift wages and strengthen our bargaining power across the labour market. A union job guarantee, to quote the great labour economist Pavlina Chernova, is about looking after those who are the first to be fired during the hard times and the last to be hired during the good times. A job guarantee is a voluntary public employment program that provides work opportunities with living wages and benefits to anyone who is willing and able to work. Unemployment has always been used as a policy tool by the bosses to undermine trade unions, undermine wages, and undermine workers. And this was starkly illustrated by some comments by property developer Tim Gerner at a business summit 2 years ago. He said,
people decided they didn't really want to work so much anymore through COVID, and that has had a massive issue on productivity. Tradies have definitely pulled back on productivity. They have been paid a lot to do not too much in the last few years. And we need to see that change. We need to see unemployment rise. Unemployment has to jump 40-50% in my view. We need to see pain in the economy. We need to remind people that they work for the employer, not the other way around. There's been a systematic change where employees feel the employer is extremely lucky to have them, as opposed to the other way around. It's a dynamic that has to change.
He continued, we've got to kill that attitude, and that has to come through hurting the economy. Governments around the world are trying to increase unemployment to get that to some sort of normality. We're starting to see less arrogance in the employment market, and that has to continue. Tim just said the quiet bit out loud. Tim just said what has been said for years around every corporate boardroom in Australia. The fight for a union job guarantee is not just about unemployment, as central as that fight is. It is about the fight for the fundamental bargaining power of workers and their trade unions. We hope that you'll join us in that fight. I'd like now to introduce Emma Dawson, Executive Director of Per Capita and one of Australia's most influential policy experts.
Thank you. To talk a little bit about the political context, where we are, how we might get further. I think the first thing to acknowledge is that we are in a moment where the ground is softer for a shift back to a Keynesian fiscal policy regime than it has been for a long time. If we look at what happened in the pandemic, yes, the government in Australia spent a lot of money. It did actually create some problems, not because of the size of the spending, but because of where it was directed. And so we have run into real resource constraints in the construction industry, for example, because of them pumping unregulated money into kitchen renovations, basically. And I know a lot of people have said, well, ha, 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 since that inflation crisis, haven't modern monetary theorists shut up? Actually, what it demonstrated was it was real resource constraints that are the problem. And obviously what they should have done was build a hell of a lot more public housing, but that ship sailed. But what we have seen in the last couple of years has been some move back towards at least a recognition of the fundamental importance of a job. And there is a recognition that a job isn't something that you are lucky to have or get only through your own merit. It is the fundamental means by which we distribute wealth in a capitalist society. And if we undermine employment, if we take opportunities away, or if we treat employment as something that is a privilege rather than a right within this system, then the system crumbles, and that's what we're starting to see. For every percentage point that the unemployment rate goes up, that the Reserve Bank thinks it needs to, that's 100,000 households out of work. So keeping those people employed is critical. We did actually manage to defeat really high inflation. It got as high as 7.2% at one point, without getting unemployment over 5%, which is what originally a lot of conservative and neoconservative economists were saying was the Nairu. Of course, you can only ever observe the Nairu in hindsight. You never really know what it's going to be. We didn't get anywhere near the kind of 5% that people were saying was necessary to bring inflation down. The review of the Reserve Bank and the changes to the Reserve Bank were good, didn't go far enough in my view, but that insistence on maintaining full employment, even that language being used again, is a shift from where we were 5 years ago, let alone 10 years ago and in the 90s. Milton Friedman obviously said that, you know, when there's a crisis, people pick up the ideas that are lying around. And the idea of a monetarism and inflation management and neoliberal economics, it didn't emerge in the 1970s. It had been developed and nurtured by that stage for 30 or 40 years through the Montpelier and Society and the Chicago School of Economics. Even Paul Keating said this a couple of years ago, it has hit its limits. It has nothing to offer the economy today. So the tools that we're told work through the neoliberal project don't work. They never did. Young people have done everything right under the neoliberal paradigm. They've got the education, they've got the skills, they've gone out and got the job, but the job doesn't come with any security and it doesn't pay enough for them to even rent a secure home. That is a broken social contract. Younger people are alive to this. They are understanding the issues much more than my generation did. And that sensibility is returning to our economic debate. So I'm hopeful, as I always have been. And if we look at the debate that's going on ahead of this productivity roundtable or economic reform roundtable, the forces of capital are tying themselves in knots to try and maintain their control of this debate. A lot of the language the government's using on the productivity roundtable, the economic reform roundtable, yes, it's conservative language. If you've looked at the financial press, at the Australian Financial Review and the Murdoch press over the last few weeks, it's still causing them to go off their nana in the vernacular. The common thing now is that we're told it's a generational betrayal, that it's a generational inequity. In the last couple of days, The Age has got a big series on the western suburbs. They're trying to paint it as a geographical divide. And I saw someone on LinkedIn saying, in Sydney, the western suburbs guy works and pays tax and the eastern suburbs guy has a trust fund and lives off a passive income. No one wants to say class. No one wants to acknowledge that this is just an ancient dispute between capital and labour, because we don't talk about class in Australia. But what we have allowed to happen is that we have created in this country probably the greatest class divide we have seen since before the Second World War. So a lot of those gains of the post-war years, of what happened with the 1945 white paper that said the purpose of an economy is to support people's well-being, has been deliberately stripped away, because basically the anger was that Keynesian economics and the rise of the union movement had given working people far too much power over the free movement of global capital. And we need to get them back where we believe they should be, which is working people are just another input to the unit of production. This was a global shift. This was a movement replacing that Keynesian social democratic economic management with a style of economic management that was explicitly designed to oppress working people and to funnel the profits and the benefits of productivity up to the owners of capital. So we can have all the fancy debates and use all the language we like about the western suburbs and the intergenerational divide, and it's important, but it's been created because the forces of capital have reasserted their control over the economy, because we were all getting a bit too big for our boots. Now, how do we turn that ship around? It's hard, right? Because we can't withdraw from the global economy tomorrow. Many of you probably know me from social media. The fact that people think I'm right-wing on these issues makes me very, very happy, because it means that society has moved much further left over my lifetime. Because when I was in my 20s, I was, you know, considered a communist by a lot of people. I'm a radical pragmatist, though. I recognise that what we need to do is shift society. It takes time. Politicians, believe it or not, will respond to what voters want ultimately. The next step has to be how we restore the direction of our economy towards people's well-being. And the reason we're where we are today in 2025 is because the left has not done its job of having the ideas lying around ready to pick up, Bill's efforts and others in this room notwithstanding. People don't understand these kind of very theoretical macroeconomic concepts. They need to understand what it means in their lives. The debate has to be had on terms and in language that ordinary people understand, but the more we maintain the message through that language, the more we can win. It is not a short-term fight or challenge. And as I said earlier, just throwing everything up in the air and starting over again is not possible without creating a lot of pain for a lot of people. So what we need to do is be gradually bringing institutions and fiscal settings back within the purview of the people. I'm not here to shut down anyone's utopian ideals. I'm an idealist. But I recognise that it actually pragmatically is going to take some radical incrementalism to get us back to where we want to be. And there is enough disenchantment with this economic system that people are starting to rebel against it. But what we need is much more solidarity on the left. There are more of us than there are of them.
Professor Bill Mitchell is Professor Emeritus in Economics at the University of Newcastle, Director of the Centre for Full Employment and Equity, and a world-leading economist on full employment and job guarantee. Welcome, Bill Mitchell, to the stage.
And what a wonderful place to be in the glorious traditions of the trade union movement. We used to come here, when I was a student at Monash University, we used to come here, and Melbourne University, here after demos, and it was a really good time for working class politics, and we're losing that, I think, unfortunately. Okay, have a look at this quote, and it's from Michael Piore. He's at Massachusetts Institute of Technology in the United States, and he was one of the guys who did all the work on segmented labour market theory and the working poor and job instability and the problems of immigrants in new labour markets and things like that. But he's not a radical. He's a middle-of-the-road sort of guy. But this is an important quote. And what it says is that whenever governments have wanted to, they have been able to reduce unemployment to the irreducible minimum. Whenever they've wanted to. There's never been a time when they've tried that they haven't been able to do that. And that gives you an insight, I think, into why we have mass unemployment. It's a political problem. It's a political issue. It's a lack of intent. This is just a very brief history. If you think about the Great Depression, this was when a major paradigm shift occurred in macroeconomics. And it was debated through the Great Depression because at the early days of the Great Depression, the British Treasury view reigned supreme, that the problem of mass unemployment that was emerging at the time was due to excessive real wages, which is the current mainstream, by the way. So in the early 30s, they cut real wages. They engineered cuts in wages so that the real wage would fall. And, of course, unemployment continued to rise. And it wasn't really until the prosecution of the Second World War, the massive government investment in blowing each other up, that the mass unemployment of the Great Depression ended. And of course, what was known then in that period between the two views, eventually governments worked out that they had the capacity in their fiscal policy capacity, government spending and taxation, to do something about the unemployment, and they had large-scale job creation programs. Now, you know, people go down every weekend down the Great Ocean Road. It's now a multi-billion dollar tourist resource for the Victorian economy. It was a job creation program. My grandfather worked on that, cutting out the cliff. It was opposed by the Conservatives at the time. For all the reasons, they still oppose anything that government might do. But if you reflect on it, it's left Victoria with a spectacular resource. And, you know, go around the world, you can document massive legacies that were achieved from mass public sector job creation during the Great Depression. If you go from the period 1945 to approximately 75 is just when Malcolm Fraser became Prime Minister in Australia with Philip Lynch as his treasurer, who led the Razor Gang, it was called in those days, where they just hacked to pieces the public sector. If you go through this period, approximately three-decade period, there was what I call an implicit guarantee of jobs within the public sector. And that was the only reason we had true full employment during that period. The private sector didn't employ everybody to create that below 2% unemployment. The standard public sector didn't do it. It was this buffer of jobs that would fluctuate. Where were they? Well, when I was a young character, as a musician and student in Melbourne, I could always go down Spencer Street rail yards. And you lined up at 7 o'clock and the timekeeper would come out and give you a number and you'd go and load goods trucks. And in that cohort, there were people who had just got out of Pentridge. There were people who had mental illnesses who couldn't possibly sustain jobs elsewhere. There were people like me who were never going to stay as a goods loader in the rail trucks, but it was incredibly important to me to get a job whenever I needed a bit of money. And moreover, before Keating hacked into the local government employment through the so-called national competitive policies, which really just handed public money to profit-seeking private corporations, you could always get a job at the council yards, in the gardens, on the rubbish trucks, all over the place. So, you know, I lived out in the eastern suburbs and you could always go up to the City of Waverley depot and get a job. That was an implicit, it wasn't explicit public policy, but it was implicit guarantee to full employment. And all through the ministries, the big infrastructure ministries, housing, roads, you were able to get jobs just like that, bang. If we go to the 70s, there were a number of schemes that Whitlam brought in. One of them was the Red Scheme, 1974. That employed something like 85,000 people in a very short time. And, you know, the Conservatives criticised that relentlessly, but what did it do? I got employed on Reds with a whole stack of other surfing bums. And what did we do? We saved all of those sand dunes from Barwon Heads right down to Torquay, planting the grasses under the Red Scheme. If you go down there now, the sand dunes are beautiful. And I could give you plenty more other examples of what the Red Scheme did. Public sector job creation, leaving legacies for the state. Of course, that was scrapped by Fraser and he brought in, you know, wage subsidies. What a joke. And at the same time, there was also the NEET scheme, the National Employment and Education Training Scheme. And NEET scheme gave me a chance to go back to university. And lots of other people were able to retrain and pursue their fulfilment. Government sector scheme. And then, of course, the paradigm shift occurred around 1975. The paradigm shift occurred on the left as well as the right. It was already occurring within the Whitlam government, by the way, when they sacked Jimmy Cairns and that awful fellow Bill Hayden came in. And his final budget, his final fiscal statement, the budget statement, was the first time in the history of documentation of those statements where they started to say, oh, the deficits are too high, we've got to cut back and pursue surpluses, blah, blah. And that was when Clyde Cameron, of course, introduced the term dole bludger as the Minister for Labor at that time. And that was the start of the construction of the unemployed as lazy, indolent, unskilled bludgers.
Labor did it.
And, you know, that was when the Labor Party lost the plot. There was a famous book by James O'Connor called The Fiscal Crisis of the State. He was a socialist, for God's sake. And this was a book saying national governments who issue their own currency can never run out of it, suddenly have all these fiscal constraints and they've got to tighten up. And you know, we had James Callaghan in Britain. He was Prime Minister of Britain, saying in September 1975 at the annual Labor conference, the thought that governments could do something about reducing unemployment, that's gone. We can't do that anymore. What governments have to do is fight inflation. These politicians have just been infested by what was going on in the academy. And in the academy, of course, by then, monetarism under Milton Friedman was taking over the academy. And in the labour economics area of the academy, and this was really influential in my early academic career because I was a labour economist and a macroeconomist, and this new idea called the new labour economics came in 1971. And the new labour economics said that unemployment is a choice by the unemployed between labour and leisure, and because they make a choice to be unemployed because they get more value out of not being employed than earning a wage and buying other commodities that they might be able to buy with their income. The academy kept saying to their students in this new labour economics, it was an optimising choice. Okay, well, optimising choices are great. That means we're getting exactly what we want. So as soon as it becomes a voluntary choice, the concept of mass unemployment disappeared. And policymakers then shifted and bought the fiction and started to say that, you know, we've got these lazy, unskilled characters living on the dole. We've got to make it much harder for them to live on the dole, and we've got to give them skills so that they can go out and get jobs. Because we don't want them on the dole. We don't want them making choices like that. And so that led to the whole shift to supply-side thinking, that unemployment was a supply issue, the withdrawal of labour by these unemployed people, and that the solution to it was pernicious reciprocation type policies to receive income support and training schemes, so relentless churning through ridiculous training schemes that did nothing. And you can't search for jobs that aren't there. The basic intuition that if there's not enough jobs, all you're going to do is train someone up to be better than someone else so that they'll take the scarce job and the other person will miss out. And during this period, we killed off manufacturing, which is another story, and we invented a new industry, and that doesn't appear in the ANZIC code, but it's a new industry called the unemployment industry. And we created a whole lot of parasitical private organisations, which used to be called the Job Network. And the whole system is just a corrupt system that does nothing for the unemployed.
That was Emma Dawson and Bill Mitchell speaking at the New Economic Vision Forum. That's a potted history of how we got to this state at the moment of high mass unemployment at the same time that we put the unemployed people through the grinder of this parasitic employment services industry, a billion-dollar industry.
Yeah.
This period of economic history in Australia that Bill and Emma are talking about, which kind of starts after World War II, end of the 40s, 50s, 60s, bit of the 70s. I had never realised before I got into MMT how this was considered like a golden age for workers because unemployment was usually under 2%. And when unemployment's under 2%, that means you've got what's called frictional unemployment, which just means people between jobs.
Just people, they're still looking for work, but...
Or they might have just finished school or uni, or they might have moved towns. They might have moved to Tarikev.
They might have moved to Tari, et cetera. Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting, the framing of it, because you and I are from that era. I remember the 60s and the 70s. And when you're raised in that environment, you don't know anything different. You think that that's just how it is. And I guess this is the thing as we get older, is I'm looking at my kids and the next generation after that, and it's a different world. This disenchantment that Emma was mentioning, you know, it's an obvious result of a system that's built to make rich people richer and introduce inequality in class.
Yes.
We're seeing the cycle repeat itself in our lifetime.
Well, I do want to kind of highlight the fact that even though it's playing out over time, and really what we're looking at is this explicit project of class warfare, this neoliberal project, even though it's played out over a generation or two, I don't want to sort of frame it as the generations who are at war with each other. It's actually a class warfare issue, even though it's, you know, now the younger people who are left with the results of all of that. And what is it the results of? It's like if we go back to the 1970s, which was just this amazing time, because what happened was you had an inflation spike that went through the economy due to an oil crisis. So we had these things called the oil shocks, where the price of oil suddenly spiked up. And of course, that caused all the prices to spike up because oil is in just about every product, even if it just means you're transporting the product around.
Yep.
And so following that oil shock, we had another kind of inflation that the economists call a wage price spiral. So that was basically capital and the workers duking it out to see who was going to bear the cost of this oil shock. So the businesses would put up their prices saying, well, our costs have gone up. And then the workers would want to say, well, we need to increase our wages because our cost of living has gone up. And that would spiral. And so that gave the neoliberal economists, you know, people like Milton Friedman, a chance to jump in and go, okay, we're going to blame the workers for this inflation and we're going to blame government spending.
This is the constant theme with the neoliberals is they miss the first step. They miss the story of money creation. They think that money is a creation of the private sector and not the government. They see a disruption in the economy caused by an oil shock, and they blame the response, not the cause. it's a constant way that they always get things asked about. They take the second step, and you sort of think, oh, maybe they're just maybe they just don't understand it properly. Listening to that whole spiel with Emma Dawson, et cetera, and Bill, you can see that these tools that they use, things like the NIRO and unemployment, they frame them as economic policies, but it is making the worker submit. It's a power play.
Exactly.
They're trying to control the class below them, the worker, who they regard as their tool, as their instrument to make them more profitable, keep them in their place. And they don't want anything that's going to disrupt that power imbalance, that class system.
Yeah, I was thinking about those tools that Emma didn't mention specifically, but aside from deliberate mass unemployment, they also use the raising of interest rates to slow down spending. So, of course, that punishes mortgage holders, which is your average household. It punishes businesses.
And we have to repeat that it's people with loans who then have to pay money to banks who then share that money with people who are rich, you know, because people with savings earning interest, and there's people with bank shares that receive the dividend of these higher interest rates. Yeah. That is the transfer of wealth, and it kind of is generational because there's generally younger people that have loans and older people that don't, but that's not because of their age. It just happens to be the statistics around it.
We do hit the younger people because one of the other tools of neoliberalism is to take a user pays approach to education. So they've hitting young people with all these high university fees and college fees. And, of course, there's the turning housing from a home into an investment vehicle through policies like capital gains and negative gearing. So yes, unfortunately, back in the 70s, that was the fork in the road, Kevin, because the Keynesian economists were pretty much running that golden age for us. And then when we had this stagflation in the 70s, where both unemployment and inflation went up, the Keynesians didn't have an answer for how you deal with it. That's where the monetarists stepped in and we got this neoliberal program. But of course, the good news is that the MMT economists do know the answer to how you deal with stagflation. And Bill Mitchell will continue to talk about the job guarantee.
You're with Anne and Kev on Radio MMT.
At 3CR Community Radio in Melbourne, Australia.
And wherever you get your podcasts.
Economics for the rest of us.
Unemployment had started to rise after the first of the OPEC oil shocks in October 73. And I understood that inflation was very high. And all of the economics profession was saying, okay, what you've got to do is push up unemployment. Because by then we had a concept called the non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment, the Nehru concept, which really came out of Milton Friedman's natural rate of unemployment, but it was just refined by Modigliani and Papademos in 1975. And this was a concept that said that there is some unemployment rate that stabilises inflation, and that if there's accelerating inflation, it must mean the unemployment rate's too low, and the responsibility of governments is to push the unemployment rate up. Now, we're talking late 70s here, but don't think that concept's gone away. Just think about our glorious Reserve Bank of Australia, who still believe in this idea, and they've been relentlessly trying to push the unemployment rate up to discipline the inflation process. Now, you know, I did my PhD on all this stuff and it's just a total shonk, I can tell you. Ask yourself about, I'm diverting for one second, ask yourself, why is the RBA, their current interest rate is by their own definition still contractionary? In other words, it's still dampening aggregate spending. In other words, they want the unemployment rate to rise further. Why are they still doing that? Why are they doing that when retail sales are starting to collapse? Unemployment rate has risen about 1% in the last year. GDP growth is at ridiculously low levels. Why is the major policy institution still trying to contract further, even though inflation peaked in December 2022 and has been falling ever since and is now at the bottom end of their targeting range? They've gone feral and they should all be sacked. So around this time, in the late 70s, unemployment was rising, inflation was high, and the mainstream debate was we've got to push up unemployment further to get the inflation down. And at that point, I got this idea. I constructed the problem in the sense that there's two buffer stock approaches to inflation stability. One is the mainstream approach, the Nehru approach, but I thought about another way of doing it through an employment buffer stock. Okay, a buffer stock's just something that goes up and down, a stock of employment or unemployment in this case. And I thought about it and I said, well, there's only really two options that governments have got. They can either discipline the inflation process through unemployment or they can do it through employment. That's the provenance of the job guarantee. Most people these days, progressives who come into this sort of literature and thinking, don't really understand this. And it's really important that you do if you're advocating job guarantee. Because it's not a employment creation program principally, even though one of its artifacts is to create jobs. Its main purpose is as a macroeconomic stability program. The logic is this, that if you've got inflation occurring through excessive spending, not through price gouging from corporations or otherwise, but one situation, if you've got excessive spending in the economy, running up against the supply capacity of the economy, so the supply capacity can't respond to the increased nominal spending through output. The only other thing that corporations can do in that case is push their prices up to ration off the excess nominal spending. If you've got that situation, and that's not a normal situation, but if you've got that situation occurring, then the policy that the government has to pursue is to cut the spending, the excessive spending. I accepted that. That's reasonable. But the way they were doing it under the mainstream approach and the current approach, and that's the Nehru approach, is that they cut the spending by creating unemployment. And the costs of that, both in terms of lost GDP, are enormous, but also the pathologies of the individuals and their families are shocking. You know, so much sociological and psychological evidence that mass unemployment just destroys people's lives. And I've thought at the time, well, there's got to be a better way of cutting spending and putting a brake on the excessive demand inflationary spiral without incurring those pathologies. And that's why I came up with the job guarantee and employment buffer stock. It's really important that people understand that, because what it means is that when the government's tightening policy parameters, reduce this excessive spending, instead of pushing people into unemployment, they also offer a socially inclusive minimum wage. So we're not talking about making people poor here, not like they are on the dole, job seeker. We're not talking about making people poor. We're offering a minimum wage job that's socially inclusive, which means you can go to the footy or the opera or a bit of a cafe occasionally, that you're not alienated from society on the basis of your income. But it's an unconditional offer to anybody that needs it. What it basically ends up doing is redistributing workers from an inflating sector into a fixed price sector. And of course, the workers that go into the job guarantee have what I call zero bid in the private market because they're unemployed. Nobody wants to bid for their work. So you're not competing with the private sector for scarce resources. You're buying off the bottom. That's non-inflationary. Basically, the job guarantee is an inflation anchor. It's a stabilising framework. We've done a lot of work over the years at my research group in Newcastle, and we've done work on selective groups like youth with psychosis and unskilled workers and all sorts of different cohorts, and they can all get a job in the job guarantee. So the point is, it can be a very inclusive, flexible scheme that allows all sorts of different workers to find some sort of job security and wage security. It allows us to have a debate about what constitutes meaningful work. Because at the moment, you know, you say job creation, the critics say, oh, it's just painting rocks. And, you know, I used to wonder, and with no disrespect, why we don't think of all those workers who sell cheap imported plastics in Kmart as being doing nothing. And I'm not criticising the workers. But the point is that what the job guarantee allows us to do is redefine what we mean by productive contribution to society. And one of the examples I use is, well, why wouldn't we offer job guarantee jobs to the Newcastle surfers who go surfing and mostly they're unemployed? What do you think they could do? What's a major problem in the Australian summer? Well, last summer it was a huge problem, drowning on Australian beaches. Well, we go out in terrible surf and jump straight into the rips because it gets us out quicker. But people who don't know water safety go into the rips and drown. So what would you get the surfers to do? Well, they could surf, that'd be fun. But you could also get them to take classes on beaches with appropriate legal qualifications to deal with children to teach them water safety. How productive would that be if school kids were taught water safety? And you can see the point I'm making. We're broadening what we mean by meaningful work. I've had a lot of resistance, obviously, over the years from trade unionists who think that I advocate creating a whole stack of minimum wage jobs and undermining the standard working conditions of workers that they've fought so hard for. Well, that's not what I'm about at all. The job guarantee is a safety net. At all times, the goal of government should be to minimise the pool of workers in the job guarantee. Not to freak out if it went up to 10% of labour force in the bad times when private sector investment was weak, but to keep it at a minimum. And when the conditions are non-inflationary conditions and the private sector is failing to invest and employ, then workers will go into the job guarantee by choice. It's demand driven. But that shouldn't be the goal of government. The government's solution to that mass unemployment shouldn't be to rely on the job guarantee. The government's solution in that more general case, when there's a downturn and recession because of private sector pessimism, is to employ people in the standard public sector on the normal wage structure. That should be the first objective of government when there's mass unemployment. But in the particular case when there's high inflation and you need to suppress aggregate spending, then the job guarantee is a perfect policy tool. And it should just be the basic minimum framework. And the latest research we've done is to model the current unemployment rate to bring it back to what we call full employment. So that would require 386,000 jobs. And in our modelling, if the government brought in a job guarantee, it would immediately have to produce 315,000 jobs, because as they were offering these job guarantee jobs, the workers would be able to get a higher income and they'd go out and spend at their local supermarket, and the private sector would get a stimulus as well through what we call the spending multiplier. So you get 72,000 jobs. Now note that the only thing that for me, that defines fiscal space, the space for governments to operate in, with their fiscal policy is the real resources that are available, not the debt to GDP and deficit to GDP. They're all just irrelevant statistics. The Australian government has infinity minus 1 cent nominal spending capacity, can spend whatever it likes whenever it wants. It's not to say that it should go wild, but what defines the limits are the real resource availability, not the dollars that, because I'm sure you know by now how governments spend. The Treasury tells finance in Canberra to ring up the Reserve Bank. Reserve Bank then instructs some computer operator to type some numbers into the banking system. That's government spending. No taxation needed. There's no debt that needs to be issued. That's all smoke screens to satisfy conservative viewpoints. Anyway, the initial investment to produce that employment response would be $32 billion. But by the time you reduce outlays on unemployment benefits, by the time you get increased taxes because wages are now being earned, by the time the corporate profits rise and indirect taxes, you end up with 24.8 net. That would be over a year. Now, if you think back to the pandemic, in 2 years, you know, they spent a huge amount of money, and I supported all that. They should have spent more. That was my argument at the time. But 24 net billion is chicken feed, even if you're worried about the government having shortage of money. So it's a no-brainer. Thank you.
You are with Anne and Kev on Radio MMT, and that was economist Bill Mitchell telling us it's a no-brainer.
Hey, now can I just summarise the NAIRU, because not all listeners might understand what we're talking about here. The NAIRU is a concept that was introduced by neoclassical economists in the mid-70s, and they say that to temper inflation, you need to have rising unemployment. Inflation starts to rise, then if you raise unemployment at the same time, it'll put downward pressure on wages, and that will put downward pressure on inflation. There's no data to back it up. There is no consistency between this theory and the real world. So it's bogus.
Not only is it economic bunkum, but it's so cruel.
Yeah. So then you ask, well, why would the neoclassical economists want this policy if it's bogus?
Well, good question.
It does two things. If it puts downward pressure on wages, it puts upward pressure on profits. Mm. So it's profitable for firms and capital to have downward pressure on wages because it increases their profits. And the other thing is it disciplines labour. It creates that control over labour to make them grateful that they can get a job.
It's more of that class warfare we were talking about.
Yeah, that's what we're talking about when we're talking about the NAIRU.
No. I'd like to talk about one aspect of the job guarantee that most of us, I don't think, understand. I might be projecting here because it took me like literally years to understand this, no matter how many times Bill was pointing it out as he did just then. And that is, what is this relationship between the job guarantee and inflation, which it is competing with the NAIRU about? And it's so weird to think that the main game is actually not the jobs that are being created, even though through this kind of job creation, we're going to prevent the development of an underclass of people who are trapped in poverty, you know, people who can't get into the job market for whatever reason, like through disability or divorce or living in the wrong place or whatever it is.
Yep.
So even though, like, these jobs are going to mitigate all those pathologies that Bill was talking about that come with unemployment, like depression and like stress and suicide and like domestic violence and teenage pregnancies and high school dropouts, all of those things that go with unemployment, the strange thing is that that's not even the most important part about a job guarantee. And to understand this, you've got to hang around these heterodox economists and listen to them talk about inflation. And what you start to understand is that this word inflation, it covers a multitude of scenarios. So these situations, they all involve prices going up and prices going continuously up and sometimes accelerating, but it isn't one monolithic thing. And so the differences in what kind of inflation it's going to be, they kind of boil down to what is causing the inflation. So the economists will look at it and say, okay, is the cause coming from the demand side? In that case, are the workers and the consumers, are they wanting to buy more stuff than the stuff is available? Or is the pressure on prices coming from the supply side, which means usually that businesses are raising their prices for whatever reason? Or is it both?
Inflation is a supply and demand mismatch. It's where supply can't provide for the demand. That's either because the supply has been disrupted or there's too much demand has suddenly appeared.
Yeah, so I do think that, you know, regular folk kind of understand that there are different kinds of inflation because we even have words like greedflation or shrinkflation or even recently I heard eggflation.
Eggflation, bananaflation.
Exactly.
And when Bill was talking about this, he said that demand side is unusual. Okay,
that's a really important point. Yep.
Yeah. So the whole thing about the Nauru is that it's based on an unusual and improbable circumstance anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So it really is a tool of discipline just used by capital.
Yeah.
But given that, if you have a situation where, like, let's say that the government did cut its spending and that did cause unemployment, you then have a choice to throw them in the heap like we currently do, or look after them properly, which is what Bill's suggesting.
The Nauru really only can deal with one kind of scenario, and the job guarantee also deals with one specific kind of inflation. And did you hear Bill say, "I accepted that"? Now, what was he accepting?
No, I thought you were asking the question, but you're going to answer me, so I'm waiting for the answer.
Rhetorical question, Kemp.
Rhetorical question.
He was accepting that in that rare case, when you do have too much demand, which is outpacing productive capacity, in that very specific and unusual case, he's accepting that the government does have to do austerity. So what does that mean? That means the government has to either cut spending or increase taxes to reduce demand. And what happens when they do that? People will start spending less because there's less money in the economy. And if people are spending less, then businesses are selling less stuff. And if businesses are selling less stuff, they're going to sack workers. And if they're sacking workers, unemployment is going to go up. But at least you've controlled this demand side inflation. And like you said, then you can either throw them onto this unemployment scrap heap, or if you have a job guarantee, you've got that as the safety net that will catch people. And like the difference is, for example, the unemployment benefit is about 2/3 of the Henderson poverty line, I think, at the moment, which is at about $18,000 a year. A job guarantee is likely to be around $45,000 a year.
40,
so that's
50.
that's the kind of difference we're looking at.
I'll give you an example that just occurred to me where you might want to cut demand. Is that we live in this very consumerist society, which is causing enormous environmental problems. To curb people's consumerism, it might be that we need to squash demand. If that was to be introduced as a policy to save the environment, then at least the people who lose their jobs are given a dignified existence to make that end.
So like a kinder version of austerity that does a lot less damage both to people and to the economy more generally.
And because they're being thrown onto the minimum wage, it's anti-inflationary.
And see, it's quite a complex thing because even if you do start to understand that the job guarantee has this anti-inflationary role that's kind of a curative thing when you do have this particular kind of inflation that's taken off, the job guarantee also has a stabilizing role, and that's where you prevent inflation taking off in the first place. And Bill was mentioning that the job guarantee is paid at a fixed rate, and that's what turns it into a price anchor, and it's anchoring the price of labor. And it's also not competing with the private sector to bid up wages. And the other thing about a job guarantee is that it's what economists call an automatic stabilizer. And automatic stabilizers are all those kinds of social security payments that are paid out counter-cyclically. So if the economy is doing well, less people will be asking for unemployment benefits, less people will be asking for housing subsidies. But when the economy is not doing so well, people will self-select to go onto these payments. That's why they're automatic. And then more money flows into a recessionary economy via these automatic stabilizers, or basically these social security payments.
The government picks up where the private sector fails and keeps businesses and keeps the economy afloat.
So, Kev, it is a wonderful thing, the job guarantee, and I'll be pretty much talking about that in Canberra on November the 1st. But we are running out of time right now, and I just wanted to remind people that if you're interested in joining a group that's going to campaign for a job guarantee, do contact Owen Bennett via Colin Long at Victorian Trades Hall. But in the meantime, Kev, good luck tomorrow.
Yes, thanks. If you don't hear from me in a couple of weeks, you'll know why. But we'll catch you again in a couple of weeks.
All right. We've got Mafalda coming up next.
You've been listening to Radio MMT with Anne and Kev.
We'd love your feedback. Email us on radiommt@gmail.com or search Radio MMT on social media.
Listen to this show anytime, wherever you get your podcasts, or on 3cr.org.au/radioMMT.
Support this show and the station by subscribing to 3cr.org.au and mention Radio MMT.
We thank all our guests.
And we thank economist Professor Bill Mitchell and his MMTED.org, educating masses on modern monetary theory.
And thank you to our listening listeners for listening. And I thank you, Kevin.
And I thank you, Anne. So what's planned for next week?
Kevin, there is still so much to talk about. We've got to expose all this rotten economics.
Well, that's good, and I get it. Do you reckon we could use a bit more music?
Well, I made a list of all these terrible economic theories. Like, have you heard of the theory of comparative advantage, or the quantity theory of money, or the loanable funds theory?
Have you heard of a band called Single Gun Theory? Like, they're a really good band. I'm sure there's a whole range of, like, macroeconomic music that I could bring into the show.
Yeah, but we really need to do marginal productivity theory, not to mention the natural rate of unemployment and the money multiplier.
You've got a pretty good singing voice. I play bass. Bill, he plays guitar. I reckon we could form a macroeconomic band. Like, we could deliver this whole message by music.
Well, we could call the band the Permanent Income Hypothesis, or the Ricardian Equivalence, or Rational Expectations.
I think we're onto something here. We're trying to make macroeconomics more interesting to the masses. We're going to, like, form this band and sing it to them. And we're going to bring the economists in. We're going to get musical.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.